Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, all of you, in I think three halls. This is one of our largest audiences in some considerable time, and I'd like to welcome you all to the penultimate lecture in this year's program of the Vancouver Institute. My name is Hector Williams. I'm president of the Institute this year. I also welcome you as the chair of the President's Advisory Committee on Lectures at UBC and a member of the Cecil and Ida Green Lectures Committee that brought Professor Rorty to us. For those of you in other rooms watching the lecture on video, I should tell you that there will be a chance to ask questions of the speaker, just as people in this hall will have a chance at the end of his talk. We'll disappear into the bowels of the building and reemerge like a jack-in-the-box in the other rooms. So if any of you are wondering about that, that's what we normally do when we have a crowd this big. Richard Rorty is one of the most well-known philosophers of our time. For over two decades, he has criticized the metaphysical aspirations of philosophy and recommended many changes toward a more pragmatic, edifying type of work. His sustained critique has had a galvanizing effect both inside and outside philosophy departments and has led to a major rejuvenation of Anglo-American philosophy in general. He was born in New York. His parents were journalists. He was admitted to the University of Chicago at age 14 to start his BA and did his bachelor's and master's degrees at Chicago before going on to Yale to complete his PhD. After military service, he went to Wellesley College as an instructor and assistant professor, and in 1962 began to teach at Princeton University. His books began to appear in 1967 with The Linguistic Turn, followed by numerous others, both books and articles that have had an enormous influence. His lectures here have been enormously popular, and I think that one critic's remarks about him will tell you why. Both his talks on campus were jammed. I saw vice presidents and deans standing at the backs of rooms because they hadn't got there a half hour ahead in time to get a seat. His works, like Philosophy in the Mirror of Nature, The Consequences of Pragmatism, Contingency, Irony, and Solitude, have addressed the fundamental questions of all thoughtful people. How can we live our necessarily solitary individual lives with dignity and self-fulfillment in the face of inevitable bodily weakness and death? And how can we engage in public life or have a critical view of public life in a fashion that supports and enacts democratic values? Tonight, Professor Rorty will speak on that subject. Do we need ethical values? Professor Richard Rorty.
Thank you, Professor William. There's an article by Jean-Paul Sartre called Existentialism as a Humanism, which is perhaps the most widely read philosophical essay of recent decades. In that essay, the most memorable and most discussed passage describes the dilemma faced by a young Frenchman during the Second World War. This young man has a choice between staying at home, tending to his aged and sickly mother, a woman who has no one else to rely on, or leaving home in order to fight against the Nazis with the Free French. Sartre tries to show that none of the ethical principles which philosophers have put forward are going to help this young man figure out what to do. The best known of these ethical principles, the ones that are discussed in every freshman ethics course and debated whenever philosophers get together, are the utilitarian principle and Kant's categorical imperative. The utilitarian principle was stated by Bentham and reformulated by John Stuart Mill It says that one should decide what to do by figuring out, as best one can, which action will result in the greatest amount of human happiness. The categorical imperative was formulated in various different ways by Kant, but his most intuitively convincing formulation says that one should never treat another human being simply as a means. Human beings should be treated as ends in themselves, as having, as Kant put it, dignity rather than mere value. Suppose that Sartre's young Frenchman asks himself whether human happiness will be increased by making his mother miserable and going off to fight the Nazis. He's very unlikely to get an answer. It's not impossible that one more fighter for freedom in the right place at the right time could make a difference to the course of the war. It's fairly certain that if every young Frenchman stayed home, that would make a difference. It's not impossible that his mother will die of grief and despair if he goes away. It's fairly certain that if all young men in search of self-fulfillment felt free to walk away from their mothers, the trust which binds the generations together would begin to dissolve. Nobody knows or could possibly know what the result of the young man's individual decision will be, but it's worse than that. Nobody even knows whether the adoption of one general rule or the other would, in the long run, increase human happiness. For nobody knows whether breaking down the loyalty of family members to one another would, in the long run, produce more or less unhappiness than Hitler's triumph. Calculation of future consequences is simply impossible, either in the individual or in the general case. But things will go no better for the young man if he turns from Bentham and Mill to Kant. Suppose he asks himself how he might avoid using other human beings merely as means. His mother can plausibly say that she will have been used as a means if he goes away. He will be treating her as someone who has no importance except to bear and nurture cannon fodder, to provide fresh blood to be spilled in wars. The Free French soldiers can rejoin that if the young man stays at home, he will be using them as means, letting others suffer so that his private world can remain intact. There's no possible world in which we could fulfill the categorical imperative by never using other human beings as means. All that Kant's principle might do is to rule out the case in which somebody is used only as a means, but it's pretty hard to imagine a situation which exemplifies such use. One candidate is the standard textbook example which Kantians use to refute utilitarians. In this example, a mad tyrant says that she will invade, burn, and enslave our country unless her hated enemy, a leader of the resistance who has taken refuge on our side of the border, is handed over. Everybody knows that if this person is handed over, the tyrant will torture her to death. Utilitarianism would seem to suggest that the choice is obvious. If all that matters is the eventual quantity of human happiness, one person's death by torture is obviously preferable to the suffering of millions. This utilitarian excuse was used by all the governments and populations who handed over their Jews to Hitler. Kantians take the fact that that resolution of the problem is far from obvious and that it appalls us as sufficient to refute utilitarianism. The example shows, they say, that something other than the quantity of human happiness is relevant to moral choice. Kantians typically go on to suggest that a doctrine of human beings as ends in themselves is the only alternative to utilitarianism. For, they say, the only reason not to hand over the refugee to the tyrant or one's Jewish neighbors to the Gestapo is that she and the Jews are human beings. The important thing about human beings, again, is that they have dignity rather than mere value, and that is why a human being cannot be treated as if she were a sack of ransom money. Utilitarians can rejoin that the fact that a country might choose honor over prudence, might choose to fight a hopeless war against the tyrant rather than turn over a refugee, is not enough to show that we need the idea of human beings as ends in themselves. Perhaps the people who would make that choice do so simply because they couldn't live with themselves if they made the opposite choice, because they can't bear to think of themselves as the people who once handed someone over to the torturers. It's not clear, anti-Kantian philosophers say, that we need any deep metaphysical claim about the difference between human beings and everything else to back up that sort of choice. Perhaps we make the choice not because we hear the call of the categorical imperative, but simply because our sense of whom we are, our self-respect, would be destroyed if we made the opposite choice. Followers of Kant, however, will insist that there must be a principle behind this sense of self-respect. And what they ask can this principle be, except that human beings are indeed special, that they differ from animals in being more than mere bearers of pleasure and pain. Utilitarianism, Kantians will say, reduces us to the level of animals, and to escape such reduction, we must have specifically ethical principles, principles which are not, like the utilitarian principle, simply prudential, simply a matter of calculating relative benefit. We need something absolute, something which categorically forbids certain actions. We can't rest content, as the utilitarian does, with a calculation of consequences. This argument between followers of Kant and followers of Mill, of which I've traced the first few steps, has gone on for a very long time. Sartre thought that this argument was a waste of time. We all create ourselves, Sartre says, by making difficult choices. This process of self-making cannot be turned over to an outside authority, an authority represented by an absolute ethical truth, an unambiguous ethical principle. It would be nice if there were such a principle. It would be nice if there were a good, clear distinction between morality and prudence, between the absolute and the relative. It would be nice if some priest or some philosopher could tell us exactly what to do when the Gestapo threatens to take our own children away unless we tell them where the Jewish children are hidden. But the hope of finding such guidance is, Sartre said, simply the hope to escape from our own freedom of choice, from the sheer difficulty of being human. The whole idea of a moral absolute, of an unconditionally binding ethical principle, is, Sartre insisted, a cop-out, an attempt to escape responsibility. The Kantians are, of course, right that the greatest happiness of the greatest number is not an absolute, but Mill's failure is not enough to demonstrate Kant's success. For the utilitarians are right that all human beings are, and always will be, means to each other's ends. The principles that each philosophical school recommends contradict each other, but we cannot adopt one to the exclusion of the other. When we are in situations like that of Sartre's young Frenchman, we shall always turn in despair from the one principle to the other and back again. No amount of ingenuity will produce a principle which gives us the firm guidance we hope to find, for principles are too crude, too abstract, too lofty to give us much help in resolving hard moral dilemmas. I think that Sartre was right in his criticism of the very idea of an absolute moral principle, the very idea that there could be a clear decision procedure for resolving moral dilemmas. So I think it would be best for us philosophy professors to give up the idea of unconditional moral obligations, obligations which we all, as human beings, stand under. It would also be a good idea for us to give up the idea that there is something called human nature and that there is a deep metaphysical divide between us and the other animals. It would be best to drop the metaphor of the moral law, the idea that God or human nature or human reason has laid down certain commandments which we have a clear, unambiguous duty to obey. The main argument against the very idea of such a commandment has been nicely formulated by the contemporary moral philosopher Annette Beyer. Beyer says in a recent book that, I quote, "The important moral questions have always been, Whom or what may I assault or kill, and when and how may I kill it, not may I assault or kill. Her point is that we no sooner formulate a good, strong, binding, absolute moral principle than we necessarily have to weaken and relativize it with 1,000 qualifications. One may not kill unless one is a soldier resisting the enemies of one's country, or is employed as an official executioner by the state, or is acting in self-defense, or in defense of one's family, and so on. One may not lie, unless telling the truth will result in serious harm, or unless one is working as an undercover agent against the mafia, and so on. Beyer has also argued that the more we insist on such absolutes, the more our failure to find them encourages a frivolous, artificial, pointless moral skepticism. The more we insist on unconditional obligations, the more stories like Sartre's will discourage us. The more we think that absolutes are necessary, the more such insoluble dilemmas will tempt us to say that everything is relative. If God doesn't exist, Dostoevsky said, then everything is permitted. If there is no eternal moral law, people say, then there is no such thing as morality after all. But of course, that sort of skepticism doesn't follow. And most of the people who draw such skeptical conclusions do so only as a rhetorical exercise. They wouldn't dream of acting out their own skepticism. The moral Beyer draws from all this is the traditional opposition between moral absolutism and moral relativism is overdramatized and misleading. The idea of moral absolutes treats us as if we were children who have to be restrained from selfish wickedness by memorizing rules and carrying them out to the letter. The idea that everything is relative, on the other hand, is an absurd attempt to pretend that it does not matter what we do. Nobody can really take either of these ideas seriously, for nobody can put either into practice. Everybody knows that we all shall sooner or later have to face the sort of dilemma which faced Sartre's young Frenchman, if not so dramatic and so poignant, certainly as difficult to resolve. Everyone knows that sooner or later appeals to principle won't help. But everyone also knows that that is no excuse for giving up, for acting like disappointed children, throwing up our hands and refusing to think or to act. The alternative to absolute principles grounded in the will of God or in ahistorical human nature is not relativism or skepticism. Rather, it's the willingness to concede that our conscience is the internalized moral consciousness of a certain historically conditioned culture, and none the worse for being just that. Our moral intuitions, our notions of what is forgivable and what is not, what is decent behavior and what we ought to be ashamed of, are the products of our having been brought up in a certain way. They are not a voice from heaven nor from the depths of the human soul. They are voices from the human past. The only ahistorical ethical conviction, the only one that stays constant throughout all historical epochs and all cultures, is the idea that there is a group whose members should be treated with respect. The idea that we should treat these people as we expect them to treat us. As soon as our cave-dwelling ancestors began to talk, they began to explain to their children how important it was to stick together, not to kill their siblings even when they were bad, and not to confuse the good people in our own cave with the disgusting people in the cave next door. Mutual respect among members of a group is a necessity for group survival, and our first moral intuitions are those of group loyalty. But most group loyalties are founded upon a sharp distinction between us and the outsiders, the people who do not have to be treated with respect. A group is a group simply because its members recognize that they have obligations to one another. Every clan, every tribe, every political unit depends upon such mutual respect. But the historians and the anthropologists tell us that very few cultures have even dreamed of making the group in question as large as the human species.
Rather, they have contrasted the people who deserve respect with those who don't. For example, the tribe across the river, the heathen across the sea, the slaves, the women, the Jews, the blacks, the homosexuals. Sometimes the people who don't count are said to be not really human, a claim which was often made about black slaves. Sometimes, as in Aristotle's account of women, and in many people's view of homosexuals, they are admitted to be human but said to be degenerate cases of humanity, bad samples of the species. I think the moral of the story, which historians and anthropologists tell us, is that morality is a matter of loyalty to and trust in people like ourselves. The difference between morality and prudence is the difference between what we do as members of a group of those like us and what we would do if we had no such membership. What we 20th century heirs of the European Enlightenment call moral progress is a matter of coming to think of more and more people as enough like ourselves to matter. It's a point of pride in our culture that we identify the moral community with the biological species rather than with any more restricted group. Christianity's suggestion that all men were brothers was a good start. But this suggestion didn't do much for the pagans, whom the Christians were quite willing to kill or enslave, nor for the heretics, whom they tortured for amusement, nor for Christian women. It took a couple of thousand years before people in the Christian West were able to take seriously the idea that all men might actually mean all human beings of whatever race or religion, male or female, gay or straight. This idea is still not taken seriously in many countries in which Christianity is the historically dominant religion. It tends to be taken most seriously in countries in which the influence of the Enlightenment was greatest. Heroes of the Enlightenment, like Kant, who wanted us to take this idea more seriously than we had in the past, suggested that even if we could no longer take the idea of a special revelation from God seriously, we should nevertheless view the Christian idea of universal brotherhood and sisterhood as a product of a universal human faculty called reason. But in the century after Kant, the idea of such a universal human faculty has fallen into disrepute. Before Darwin, it was plausible to think of our species as categorically distinct from other species of animals. After Darwin, this became difficult. And it has also become very difficult to take the idea of an unchanging human nature seriously. Yet, Darwinian biology, together with archaeology and anthropology, does offer us a plausible story of how the apes changed into a kind of animal capable of formulating ethical principles. This gradual change consisted in the gradual acquisition and growth of language. On a Darwinian account, language is not a symptom of the presence of rationality. It's the other way around. Human beings have reason because they can talk. They don't talk because they're rational. And the more they can talk, the more rational they are. To be rational is just to be able to do things as a result of persuasion rather than out of sheer habit or in response to the threat of force. This ability, the ability to have one's life changed by words rather than by blows, doesn't require that we be categorically distinct from the animals or that we have anything special inside of us except a lot of easily modified neural connections. A lot of readily reprogrammable circuitry. If evolutionary biologists can explain the extra neurons, and the anthropologists and historians can explain the recurrent reprogramming, we have no need for the hypotheses offered by the theologians and the metaphysicians. This seems to me an additional reason for not taking seriously the notion of human beings as a metaphysically distinct kind, and for not looking for deep metaphysical reasons why it's okay to kill cows but not people, or Muslims but not cows, and for not expecting a deep and interesting answer to questions about just when and why a killable human embryo becomes an unkillable human person. It's also a further reason for thinking that we should change our attitude toward ethical principles. Traditionally, philosophers have seen ethical principles as reposing upon deep epistemological or theological or metaphysical truths. They've seen such principles as attempts to spell out something which is somehow written into the nature of things or written into the human mind. It would be better, I want to suggest, to think of ethical principles as summaries of past human practices or projections of future human practices, practices which are backed up by nothing more than the choices which various human societies have made in the course of history and the experiences which they have had as the result of making those choices. From this point of view, the superiority of our culture, the culture which draws upon both Christianity and the Enlightenment, our claim to be more open to reason than most cultures, amounts to our satisfaction in belonging to a self-questioning culture. We are, I think, justified in thinking that we are more rational than most of our ancestors, but this superior rationality does not consist in knowing more truths, nor does it consist in having firmer principles. It consists, on the contrary, in being more open-minded, more tolerant, less certain of our practices and of ourselves, more willing to listen to people who engage in different practices and cherish different principles. If you think of ethical principles in this way, as summaries of past practices, then to say that a person habitually acts on ethical principles is just to say that he or she thinks before acting, and specifically thinks about what sort of practices a certain action would or would not fit in with, about what sort of person would act in one way and what sort would act in another way, and whether he or she really wants to engage in a certain practice and be a certain sort of person. To say that she has firm principles is to say that she is reliable in the sense of not acting out of sudden impulse, and also in the sense of thinking about people other than herself. But of course, to say that her action was performed out of a sense of ethical principle is not to say that her action was the right one. For the principles acted upon may be the principles which summarize the practices of the wrong group, sum up the behavior of the wrong sort of person. Nazis had ethical principles. Slave owners had ethical principles. The men who subjugated women for the first few thousand years of recorded human history had principles. Cherished ethical principles are as common as and as disparate as social practices. When people praise a person for having firm ethical principles, they're implicitly praising them for belonging to the right community, being the right sort of person. If Plato and Kant had been correct in believing that all human beings were at bottom the same, thanks to their shared faculty of reason, that acculturation and historical location were only skin deep, then there would indeed be only one set of ethical principles. But Plato and Kant were wrong. Moral intuitions, the sort of intuitions which are summarized in ethical principles and which help make shared social practices possible, are up for cultural grabs. Keeping women in bondage to men is not repellent to reason, nor would it be repellent to reason to make whites subordinate to blacks or Europeans to Asians. There is no neutral, uncontroversial common ground which ties 6th century Athenians, 17th century Chinese, and 20th century Canadians together and permits them to use Socratic discussion to resolve their disagreement about which sorts of people count. But to restate a point I made earlier, because Plato and Kant were wrong, it doesn't follow that people who say that ethics is just a matter of taste or ethical choices are arbitrary are right. Sartre, alas, sometimes echoed Nietzsche's claim that the only authentic reason for acting is because I will it. But such Sartrean Nietzschean suggestions are merely the flip side of the Platonic Kantian claim that only absolute ahistorical transcultural reasons count as good reasons. It doesn't follow from the absence of moral absolutes that every set of ethical principles is as good as every other. That would be like saying that since we cannot be sure that contemporary science's account of the physical universe is the last word, and indeed strongly suspect that it is not, any scientific hypothesis is as good as any other. It doesn't follow from the fact that we may share no neutral premises with the Nazi, and hence may be unable to convert him to our view by Socratic persuasion that his views are as good as ours. The main reason this doesn't follow is, as I said earlier, that the proposition every ethical principle is as good or bad as every other is one that nobody can actually take seriously. Nobody can act on this proposition because everybody has been raised within one or more communities and raised to identify himself or herself with some social practices rather than others. We can never assume the Sartrean role of a naked, uncommitted, uninvolved chooser. We couldn't jump out of our own skins and become moral relativists or moral skeptics or moral nihilists, even if we wanted to. Platonists or Kantians sometimes say that if you give up the quest for unconditional, unquestionable moral absolutes, you give up your humanity. That it's the search for absolute and objective truth that makes us truly human. That claim to me seems to me just plain wrong. What makes us human is the hope of justifying our beliefs and our actions to others, the hope of using words rather than blows in our dealings with one another. The ethical principles which summarize the practices of the 20th century culture of the Europeans and the North Americans are, so to speak, the least common denominator of Christian, utilitarian, and Kantian principles. That is to say, they are egalitarian principles, principles which say that we need to downplay the differences and emphasize the similarities between the members of our species. The Enlightenment, the moral and intellectual movement of which both Bentham and Kant were prophets, was primarily an attempt to break down the distinctions which had previously divided Europe into sovereigns and subjects, nobles and commoners, clergy and laity. The point of all the Enlightenment rhetoric about the need for nature and reason to replace prejudice and superstition was simply to persuade people to take those old distinctions less seriously, to see every language user as a conversational partner and potential equal. Bentham said that we should find laws whose application maximized the happiness of all the inhabitants of a country rather than just some. Kant said that we should test our social and political maxims by the principle of publicity. That is, if we cannot tell everyone concerned what those maxims are, there must be something wrong with them. John Rawls, a leading contemporary moral philosopher, has said that a social practice should not distribute social benefits unequally, unless doing so is to the advantage of the least advantaged members of that society. He's backed up this principle, which he calls the difference principle, by the argument that if we had to choose a community to belong to, and to choose in ignorance of our talents, skin color, sex, family background, and life chances, we should all wish to live in a community which abided by the difference principle, for self-interest dictates that we not take our chances in an inegalitarian society. Rawls is right that that would be our choice, but he begs the question of whether a community tailored to the needs of the least talented, the least advantaged, is the best sort of community. I agree with him about what we would choose and what we should choose, but I agree with his critics that he begs the question. Nietzsche, for example, would say that Rawls's utopia, the social democratic welfare state, is, like the Christian utopia of universal human brotherhood, a suitable utopia for the weak, for the naturally slavish, but that it has no particular claim on the strong. He would say that Bentham, Mill, and Kant beg the same question, as does Rawls. I think Nietzsche would be right to say that, but I also think that this charge of question begging would be pointless. Some questions have to be begged. Sometimes our spade is turned. That is the kernel of truth in Sartre's claim that sooner or later we just have to decide what sort of person we want to be, what sort of community we want to be part of. We don't make this decision arbitrarily, but that doesn't mean that we can persuade everyone to make the same decision, or that we can avoid begging some of the skeptical questions which people like Nietzsche put to us. The egalitarianism of the post-Enlightenment West is not, it seems to me, grounded in anything more basic than the history of Europe and North America, the history of an exceptionally rich and exceptionally lucky fraction of the human race. That history offers us the spectacle of the strong and powerful very slowly and gradually admitting more and more of the weak and powerless to membership in a common moral community. The history of this fraction of humanity is the history of an unprecedented expansion in people's sense of who counts as us, their sense of which kinds of people matter. To identify with this historical movement is to adopt the ideal of making every member of our biological species a member of our moral community. But nothing, it seems to me, lies behind that historical movement. Not human nature, not the will of God, not the force of reason. There is nothing there except our lucky ancestors, or more exactly, a certain selected group of ancestors whom we have picked out for imitation. Let me now summarize what I've said in answer to the question I posed in my title, do we need ethical principles? On the one hand, I've been agreeing with Sartre that we should not expect moral principles to do what custom, education, and tradition fail to do. They won't help us make hard choices. On the other hand, I've been arguing that we can never dispense with ethical principles, for such principles are indispensable elements in our self-image, indispensable ways of explaining to ourselves who we are. These two claims, I think, can be synthesized by saying that although we always need ethical principles as reminders, we can never use them for reassurance. We can't use them to guarantee that we are the right sort of people, for we can never decide what kind of people to be simply by summoning up reminders of what we were taught or of the way we have lived until now. We have to keep in mind the possibility that we may have been, in certain respects, badly brought up. We have to remind ourselves that the way we have lived till now may not be the way we should have lived. We usually ask a question like, am I the right sort of person? Only when some difficult moral dilemma has made us wonder whether we were taught as well as we might have been, or whether we have lived as well as we might. When the creation of a new self is in prospect, principles fail us. What helps at that point are not principles, but examples, concrete stories about the results of our past actions, or the results of the social practices of our community, or utopian stories about the brave new worlds which might come into existence if we changed those practices. The process of shedding old principles and acquiring new ones can, I think, usefully be compared to the process of growing up. We all need principles for the same reason we all need parents. We need to become acculturated into a social group. Parents prevent us from growing up into snarling, biting little animals. One of the ways they carry out their task is to tell us things like, we don't lie, we don't hit people, we don't call people kike, or nigger, or chink. Another way is to tell us that all men are brothers, or that we should act so as to increase human happiness, or that we should never use another human being merely as a means. But sooner or later, everybody has to get beyond their parents. They have to start making themselves rather than being made by somebody else, even by people whom they love. They have to grow up. As for individuals, so for groups and societies. No society can keep its traditional practices intact forever, for the environment will have changed since the days when those practices first took shape. If a society tries to stick to the old ways too long, it will either go under or become paralyzed. The principles which abbreviate the traditional practices will sooner or later have to be gradually modified beyond recognition or else abandoned altogether. It's as bad for societies to let their ancestors' practices go unquestioned as it is for individuals to spend their adult lives trying to please their parents. So much by way of summary. In the time that remains, I'd like to take up a concrete case of moral change and moral progress, the rise of feminism. I think this example helps confirm what I've been saying so far. For one of the striking things about demands that women be treated equally with men is that, except for Plato and John Stuart Mill, none of the great formulators of ethical principles seem to have thought twice about women. Christianity left women still occupying pretty much the same subservient roles they had played in the pagan world. When, during the Enlightenment, women like Mary Wollstonecraft and Olympe de Gouges asked the men whether perhaps they too might get some of the benefits of the new spirit which was changing the face of Europe, they were told not to be ridiculous. Kant simply took for granted that women were pretty much like children. Females would, he thought, always need to have the moral law interpreted to them by the relevant males. Contemporary feminists don't have much to say that wasn't said by Mary Wollstonecraft at the end of the 18th century and reiterated by Harriet Taylor and John Stuart Mill in the middle of the 19th. But it wasn't until the beginning of this century that the men could be persuaded to let women vote or get university degrees, and it wasn't until the last few decades that women began to get even token representation in positions of power. If we regard these recent changes as examples of moral progress, then it will pay us to ask, what was the role of ethical principle in bringing that progress about? I think the answer to this question is principle had very little role. In the last 200 years, no revolutionary new ethical principles have been discovered or adopted. The principles stayed the same, but the group which applied the principles to each other, the group of people who thought of each other as sufficiently like each other, gradually changed its membership. It gradually enlarged, admitting more and more people, but until very recently, only male people. When people discussed hard ethico-political questions in the 18th and 19th centuries, the centuries in which enlightened public opinion became for the first time a real force, the people were male. When politically informed and active people used the word we in sentences like, we can't put up with this, the word referred only to males. Feudalism declined, glaciers receded, the bourgeoisie rose, the democratic revolutions took place, truces were reached between capital and labor, and in each case, the reference of the political we expanded. But it didn't expand far enough to include females. Whole social classes were taken into account by politicians in 1900 who had never entered the thoughts of politicians 200 years before. But few people, and indeed few women, gave women a second thought. Women remained invisible, even to themselves. They were thought of, and for the most part thought of themselves, not as members of society, but as members of families. For socio-political purposes, only male heads of families mattered. The one socio-political principle on which all civilized societies, Asiatic as well as European, Christian as well as pagan, have agreed, the one transcultural and transhistorical moral absolute has been that women do not count for as much as men. As an example of the impotence of appeals to principle to enlarge the range of the socio-political we, consider a notorious decision of the Supreme Court of Canada. In the 1920s, some sharp-eyed feminists noticed that the rules for electing people to the Canadian Senate spoke of persons rather than men. So they sued to permit women to run for the Senate. The Supreme Court was surprised, appalled, and annoyed. The judges had to admit that the word person is usually meant to include females as well as males, and that a literal application of the law would force them to decide in favor of the feminists. But they knew that if they did so, they would look ridiculous in the eyes of the only people who mattered, their fellow males. So they saved the situation by saying that person should not be construed to include women because it had never been so construed in the past. This is an illustration of a point I was urging earlier. Principles, like laws, are summaries of practices and have little force when they cease to be such summaries. They don't constrain practices, they abbreviate practices. When a hard case comes along, we don't ask the law or the principle what to do. Instead, we ask how the principle has been applied in the past. Asking that question may or may not provide sufficient guidance. If it doesn't, as it often will not, we have to find something other than principle to which to turn. The obvious turn to make is from the universal to the particular, from theory to anecdote, from principle to narrative. When the Supreme Court of the United States overturned the doctrine that separate but equal facilities for blacks and whites were sufficient to satisfy the requirements of the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, they cited evidence about the effect of segregated education on black children. In its opinion, the court footnoted not just statutes, precedents, and constitutional clauses, but books which recited anecdotes about how it felt to be a black child in the southern states, and which told stories about what had happened to such children. Similarly, feminist initiatives, both the one at the beginning of the century, which culminated in winning votes for women, and the one which is now trying to win economic and social equality for them, has relied upon anecdote and narrative. From Olive Schreiner at the beginning of the century to Margaret Atwood nowadays, narratives of women's lives have broken the path for feminism by helping the males realize what happens to the people who have the bad luck to be born female. Novels, biographies, autobiographies, and little inventions like Virginia Woolf's story about Shakespeare's sister have given us reason to think that familiar ethical principles ought to be applied to people to whom we had never previously thought of applying them. Our ethical principles nowadays are pretty much the same as those to which Mary Wollstonecraft appealed, but our application of them differs from the way the same principles were applied in the 18th century. The difference has not, I think, been made by taking our principles more seriously. It has been made by becoming more imaginative, more aware of concrete details. The anecdotes and narratives which have made the difference have made men notice what was being done to women, just as similar anecdotes and narratives finally brought the whites in the United States to notice what was being done to the blacks. In the United States, the term we, as it is used in socio-political deliberation, is now less likely to mean we white males than it did in 1900. In Canada, I take it is less likely to mean we males than it did in the 1920s when the court handed down the decision I cited. The males in both countries have become more imaginative in the intervening years, but they have no stronger or weaker a sense of moral obligation than they had before. Moral obligation, like moral principle, stays constant throughout such histories of moral progress. What changes sensitivity and imagination is something that doesn't have much to do with either. Annette Beyer, to whom I referred earlier, and who seems to me the most original of contemporary moral philosophers, has suggested that we see the difference between ethical principle and ethical sensitivity as correlated with the difference between paternal and maternal roles. I think that Beyer is right in saying that feminism might help us change our whole conception of what it is to behave ethically, so I'll end by developing briefly Beyer's suggestion. From Beyer's point of view, the idea that the central element in a truly ethical life is an unswerving allegiance to principle is a specifically masculine idea. It's associated with the idea that obligation is the central ethical concept, the idea that left to ourselves we should behave badly, behave like animals, and that we need unconditional principles to correct these natural animal tendencies. It's also associated with the opposition between human reason and animal passion. Writers like Kant, who speak of the sublimity of duty, are in Beyer's view perpetuating the dualism of higher, specifically human faculties, and lower animal faculties. Such writers encourage the idea that the transformation of our children from snarling, biting little animals into human beings is accomplished by the development of these higher, specifically rational faculties, and specifically by the development of a sense of unconditional moral obligation. Beyer agrees with Nietzsche that there is something terribly wrong with Kant's way of looking at the matter. Beyer thinks Nietzsche was right when he said, I quote, "A bad smell of sadomasochism, the reek of blood and torture, lingers on Kant's categorical imperative." Rather than thinking of the sense of duty as a matter of absolute and unconditional obligation, Beyer suggests that we think of it in terms of the development of a sense of justified trust, the sort of trust which the child originally has in its mother and which its mother teaches it to have in other people. For Beyer, the child is made rational, and thus human, by its mother training it to respond to words rather than to blows. It is traditionally the mother's task to make the child into someone who can love and trust, someone who is not constantly wolfishly on guard. Only after this initial process is substantially completed can the idea of unconditional imperatives, either moral or legal, get a foothold in the child's mind. Only after the mothers have done their work can the fathers come along and explain to the male child that its masculinity as well as its rationality depend upon unconditional adherence to certain commandments. As Beyer sees it, the customs and traditions of a patriarchal society have caused moral philosophy to focus on this second, specifically paternal, stage. That's why moral philosophy has always concentrated on principles rather than anecdotes, imperatives rather than narratives, commandments and laws rather than utopian imaginings. If Beyer is right, as I think she is, then we should amend my previous suggestion that principles are like parents. We should be more specific and say that principles are like stern and upright fathers, often helpful, but often inclined to give themselves too much importance. To take either our fathers, or the social practices of the past, or the principles which summarize those practices at their own valuation is not a good idea. Moral maturity requires keeping in mind that our mothers were usually the ones who made us able to trust and to love, even if our fathers were the ones who taught us to make impartial, rule-governed judgments. It also requires us to keep in mind that rules and principles are no better than the practices they summarize, and that moral progress depends on changing traditional practices, putting aside reliable maxims for the sake of imagined utopias. We shall always have to alternate between judging and trusting, just as we shall always have to alternate between relying on our instinctive emotional responses and relying on explicit principles and laws. As Sartre's example shows us, I think, neither can be counted on ever to provide clear and certain guidance, but moral maturity requires both societies and individuals to outgrow the hope of ever getting such guidance. Thank you.
There is an opportunity for questions now. I suspect there may be a few.
Professor Rorty, you talk about the need for society to grow up, and I'm wondering where you feel society is right now on that growth continuum. Are we still children, young adults, teenagers?
The question was, where are we in this continuum of maturation? You know, children, teenagers, adults. I don't know. My feeling is that the pace of moral maturation has accelerated greatly since the Enlightenment, that we do all kinds of things now that 200 years ago we would never have dreamed of doing, taking kinds of people serious. The people in power take kinds of people seriously whom 200 years ago they would never have dreamed of taking seriously. So things have been changing pretty fast. Enthusiasts for animal rights say that we've barely begun because we're still working on just the human beings and we haven't even started on the animals. Environmentalists sometimes suggest that moral concern is properly for the planet as a whole. For all I know, these people are onto something. Their suggestions, I think, sound no crazier to us than suggestions that we take blacks and women and homosexuals seriously sounded 200 years ago. But that doesn't necessarily mean that we have to act on those suggestions. I don't know whether we have to act on them or not. What I had in mind was that suppose we are inclined to take a certain decision and we say to ourselves, this must be the right thing to do because it accords with the following principle. We use the principle to reassure us. This, it seems to me, is too easy. That is, we are likely to not notice the effects of our action just insofar as we rely for reassurance on principle. What principles do, and I think all they do, is to say, remember the following sorts of considerations. Bear in mind the following kinds of past instances, the following kinds of familiar paradigms. Think about those similar cases. It seems to me when they do that, they do all the work they can do. And if you allow them to do the extra work of reassurance, you're probably shirking your duty. The question was, is there room in all this for care for the self, for just ordinary hedonic satisfaction? It seems to me that, in leisured civilized societies, of course there is. Not all societies will permit that amount of security and leisure. I think that you're never going to get a principle which will tell you how to divide your life between private hedonic satisfaction and care for self and your responsibilities to the rest of the moral community. Life is never going to be that simple. You will never know whether it's okay to spend 2 days out of the week on yourself and 5 on the others, or whether it should only be 1 and 6. Rather than a question of views, how is it possible Well, the question is, if it makes no sense to decide because there's no independent criteria, and then how can you say that a question has been begged against the Nazis or against Nietzsche? My argument is that you can't say it makes no sense to... Sorry, how did you put it? I've lost track of the phrasing. What I want to say is that the idea that you can't really make a choice unless you have an independent criterion is just wrong. There is no such thing as a criterion neutral between us and the Nazis or between us and Nietzsche. We haven't the slightest idea of what it would be like to find such a criterion. We do make meaningful moral choices all the time, and we do it in the absence of such neutral criteria. It seems to me the idea that there have to be neutral criteria before you can make a rational decision is a specifically Platonic fiction, which we could usefully do without. The question is, why can't we just say we're different from the Nazis? Why do we also have to say that we're better? It seems to me that we have to think about the choice between being who we are and being who the Nazis are, because roughly there's a little of the Nazi in us and there's a little of us in them, and moral progress is made by different groups of people seeing how far they can go in talking to one another about these differences and how the differences might be reconciled. I don't think there's ever a point at which you can just say, you know, it would be silly to talk to these people. You won't know until you've tried. They won't know until they try with us. We won't know until they try with them. At the end of the conversation, both sides may conclude that the question has been begged and the other side is reasoning in circles. If that's so, they will go to war. But that's what they're going to have to do.
You were talking about the white male dominant power group now taking service in groups they would never have thought of threats of taking service to 100 years ago. When you say taking seriously, do you feel there is a real attempt on part of male pragmatists, paternalist pragmatists, to really understand the psyche and the temperament of those groups who have been outside or in conflict with what they found acceptable before, or whether they still are trying to incorporate for reasons of threat to their own power or whatever.
The question is, are the white paternalistic male pragmatists seriously trying to figure out what's going on in the experience of the oppressed, or are they just pragmatically trying to co-opt them or incorporate them? A little of both, I should think. I guess I think it doesn't make, you know, it doesn't matter whether the oppressors can experience the oppression which they have caused. It doesn't matter whether they can really stand in the shoes of the people they're oppressing. What matters is simply that they talk to them. I mean, you know, the question of, you know, will you ever know what I suffered doesn't matter so much as will you listen to what I'm saying now? And there, you know, yeah, there is more listening now.
You talked of the importance of group loyalty in tradition and our behavior. Sometimes when people move from one group to another, one society to another, one culture to another, there develops a conflict between their old group and the new group. Example that comes to mind is the claim by some groups that come into taken on the American society that the practice of female circumcision should be allowed in our culture. And generally, we ask that those of us who have grown up in North American society generally react to that fairly negatively. We think, for example, that we have the right to make a law allowing such a practice because of our group loyalties, our history, and our habits of behavior.
The question is, does Canadian society as a whole have a right to make a law banning female circumcision among immigrant groups? You know, I think it does, but I don't have a nice argument to offer why not. I mean, I tend to think that the price which immigrant groups have to pay for getting in on the pluralist, democratic, Christian Enlightenment tradition is going to be a considerable sacrifice of individuality and autonomy. It seems to me a reasonable price. That is, you know, our Enlightenment culture put in a lot of work to try to build a nation or set of nations which could tolerate this amount of plurality, and there's a limit to how much plurality any society can tolerate. So I don't think that you can suddenly start saying every culture has a right to autonomy. I mean, obviously there are certain cultures whose practices are so horrible that nobody thinks they have a right to autonomy. Not, you know, whether they're here among us or whether they're off in the rest of the world. So just having a cultural tradition is hardly enough to, you know, to give anybody any rights. You got to take every cultural tradition and weigh it against the neighboring cultural traditions, just like you got to take every human being and weigh him or her against the neighboring human beings.
We'll take some questions.
Okay.
We'll go to one of the other rooms and take some questions, but the sound will be piped into here. Then we'll return here for one or two final ones. So don't go away.
The question is whether my stuff about maturation and growing up implies a telos for humanity, that is, implies that, you know, there is a goal out there to be reached. I don't think it does. I think that, you know, we grow up as best we can, all of us, and we never know whether we're heading in a direction that has been laid down in advance. I think it is with the human race as with the individual. It just doesn't pay to speculate. Has someone envisaged my goal already, or am I making it up as I go along? It feels as if we're making it up as we go along. And the philosophers or the theologians claim that, you know, somehow there is already within us a built-in goal, seems to me one that, you know, has no pragmatic consequences.
Yes, On the contrary, those are the people who, it seems to me, we look back on and say they had a kind of imagination which most of their contemporaries didn't have. That is, the first time some Greek said, maybe we shouldn't own slaves, or the first time some white slave owner said, come to think of it, maybe these are men and brothers. You know, everybody thought they were crazy, but we look back at them and say, you know, thank God somebody noticed. That seems to me exactly the role of moral, moral heroes are only recognized in retrospect. So to speak. I think it would depend entirely on the teenager and what rule they had in mind. I mean, in the case of some rules, you obviously have to, lock them in their room. In the case of other rules, you can say, yeah, you've got a point. That's presumably a great time saver for the educators. I'm prepared to believe it. It's just that even if that particular practice has already sort of been ruled out by the genes, that doesn't get us much further with most practices. There may be. I'm inclined to think that, so to speak, biology has done about all it can, and that from here on it's up to culture, and that, warring cultures take over where biology threw up her hands. I guess it doesn't seem absurd to me. I mean, it seems to me the great triumph of the modern democracy is to have created communities on this almost unprecedented scale, with all the pluralism and all the conflict, nonetheless, the sense that, we Canadians, we citizens of the United States, there are some things we won't do because it's, un-Canadian or un-American or something of that sort. This is a very precious cultural heritage. The question is, will I elaborate on my suggestion that maybe animal rights activists are onto something? I guess all the elaboration I can offer is that it doesn't seem to me at all impossible that in the more rich and secure and literate parts of the world, everybody will be vegetarian at the end of the next century. There seems to be a sort of drift in that direction. It obviously isn't going to happen around the world, because there are some people who will starve if they don't eat the local reindeer or something like that. But that possibility just, I simply don't know what to say. I'm sort of in the position of a slave owner in the 18th century being told at the end of the next century nobody will own slaves. Well, gee, maybe they're right, but I can't really get my mind around the possibility. I think it can't be as simple as that. Yeah, the question is, since animals don't have responsibilities, they can't have rights, because rights and responsibilities are correlative. I think that it can't be that easy, because infants don't have responsibilities either, but you're still not supposed to treat them any old way. You're supposed to take care of them and so forth. Some of the organisms, if you like, that we treat, that we hesitate to use simply as means, don't seem to have any particular responsibilities to us. The very aged, the very ill, the very young, and so on, we act as we do toward them because, it would be incompatible with our own honor and dignity to act differently. It isn't so much that, it's a give and take. It's we wouldn't be able to live with ourselves if we didn't take care of the aged, the very young, and so on. And for all I know, it might turn out to be that way with animals. Yeah, it's a good question. I think you're right that I am presupposing.
Should I repeat it?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Let me repeat the question. When I assume that the more complex relationships between groups and the more complex forms of communication there are between groups, the more mature a society is, am I simply making the same assumption that Kant made in a slightly weaker form, some assumption about human dignity consisting in conversability or something like that? Yes, I am. And I think that much of the Enlightenment, none of us can really help inheriting. The thought is that whether or not there's this truth-cracking faculty called reason, what makes us better or morally more mature is being able to talk about more things in more complicated ways with more different kinds of people. I just don't see how we can let go of that. I don't want to claim that it's an objective criterion. It's just that if we didn't use that criterion of moral maturation or moral progress, I wouldn't be able to use the history of the West as an example at all. There, they are, frankly, in the situation of the animals. They are, you know, they either learn how to talk or are dependent on our mercy. It's a bad position to be in, but that's the position they're in. Yeah, I think the question, the last question was, does everything revolve around the way we do things in the West? For us here in the West, yes. That is, there is just no way we are going to step outside of our Western skins and start seeing the history of Europe and North America as just one of many possibilities with no special privilege. We couldn't do it if we tried.
One more question, then we have to go to another room.
Yes, that is, I think the question is there anything more basic than culture behind moral integrity? And really, most of what I was saying is, no, there isn't. That is, once you get beyond maybe a biologically ingrained incest taboo, as was suggested, all the other questions are cultural through and through. And, you know, you're not going to get any help by looking into, deeper into your genes. I prefer to say that this, the view I'm offering is anti-rationalist, where to be a rationalist is to assume, with Plato and Kant, that underneath cultural differences there is a source of moral intuitions which is non-cultural. It seems to me that, you know, we're in a better position than Plato, or indeed than Kant, to say, no, that turns out not to be the case.
There is yet a third room to take questions in, so we must pass on. I think the question is the sense of progress absolute or relative? I guess the best one can say is, if it's absolute, we'll never know it, so we better just assume that it's relative. That is, let me start that over again.
I guess what I want to say is consider an adolescent sort of desperately trying to, become himself or herself, wondering whether, in fact, he or she is heading in the right direction. I can't see what use it would be to somebody in that position to ask, is my progress absolute or relative? I mean, I just don't see what good the question, what good that alternative does to consider. The question is about whether commercial television contributes to the imagination that I was saying was essential to moral progress. Yeah, I think it does. That is, I think that the accessibility to narratives of the lives of strange kinds of people is much greater in the age of television than it has ever been before. I think the great instrument of moral progress in the 19th century was the novel, and it's quite possible the great instrument of moral progress in our century is the soap opera. That is, simply dramas about kinds of people whom the audience would not ordinarily have a chance to meet, facing situations that whose difficulty they might not have been able to imagine without the soap opera. I'm not sure if that's what you meant, but... The question is, do I agree that we can't mature until we North Americans achieve understanding of Asian societies? I think it's very hard to know whether Asian societies are still going to be very Asian a generation or two from now. That is, I think the process of industrialization, the global network of communications, is such that cultural differences are disappearing faster than we can keep track of them. And at a certain point, it becomes merely fetishistic to worry about, is this a distinct culture or is it a minor variation of my culture? Or for that matter, am I a minor variation of their culture? Yeah, I'm sure there are counterexamples, but it doesn't do the women nowadays much good. The question was, haven't there been societies in which women weren't considered one step down from men? Doubtless there have been, just as there have been societies like ancient Athens where homosexuals weren't sneered at, but that doesn't do contemporary women or contemporary gays much good. The question is, can I offer guidelines for formulating new practices? No, I think the moral of Sattva's story is just that the process of self-creation, either individual or social, has to be done without guidelines. You know, if it You know, if there were guidelines, then human life would be very different than, in fact, it is. I mean, we wouldn't have to do this complicated thing called creating a self for ourselves, but we do. The question is, what good does it do if mothers raise the kids decently once they get in, once they're drafted into the military later on? I think all one can say is that one of the promises of feminism is that the male notion that you're only a real man if you can kill might gradually be weakened by a in a less patriarchal society. And the military option might seem less attractive to young males than it has seemed so far, but that's just a hopeful guess.
I think we'll go back to the main room now. Professor Rorty has been talking for the last hour and a half. Perhaps take one or two questions here.
I'm a little troubled about what you said about immigrants having to pay a certain price to buy into the Western tradition. Is it possible to say that the price that the Western liberal Christian tradition has to pay to be more inclusive is to perhaps reconsider or give up some of its ethical values?
The question is, may not the West have to give up some of its ethical values